Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. My name is Armand Childers, and this is the New Books Network. I have the pleasure of hosting Marlene Schefers today, whose book, Voices That Matter, Kurdish Woman at the Limits of Representation in Contemporary Turkey, just recently came out of University of Chicago Press. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm very excited to be talking to you today. So before we get into the book, can we get to know you a little bit?
Yes, of course, sure. So my name is Marlene Schefers. It's as I said, I'm really, you know, excited to be on the podcast today, and I have a background in anthropology. I'm currently an assistant professor in cultural anthropology at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. I should also say perhaps that I also have a background in history, actually. So I studied history as an undergraduate, and I did a master's degree actually in Ottoman and Turkish history. But eventually I ended up doing anthropology, quite happily so, I should say. And I did a PhD in the UK and have been engaged in anthropological research ever since.
Yeah, great. And I didn't know you studied history, actually, which is funny because I've known you for a while. And how did this book come about?
So this book basically is the outcome of, or it's based on, ethnographic fieldwork that I did for my dissertation project. And for that fieldwork, I went to, I worked in the city of Van in eastern Turkey, or what's also known as northern Kurdistan. And during my time in the field, I worked with a group of Kurdish female singers called Dengbej in Kurdish, who had just started organizing themselves to set up a civil society organization when I arrived in Van in the summer of 2011, so at the beginning of my fieldwork. And these were mostly middle-aged to elderly women who were extremely keen on asserting their presence in public, even though most of them had actually quite horrific stories to tell about both political and gendered forms of violence that they had experienced for wanting to raise their voices in public and perform their singing in public. And so both their Kurdishness and their gender meant that their voices had been, you know, suppressed, silenced, and denied for a very long time. And yet here they were, you know, despite all this, all these stories of violence and suppression, having just founded this civil society organization for Kurdish female singers, and insisting really that their voices should matter and that they wanted to raise their voices in public. And the book is really an attempt to understand and also honor that immense desire for voice on the part of the women that I encountered during my fieldwork. And instead of assuming that desire for voice, you know, that I observed on the part of these women to be simply sort of naturally given, the book in a way asks what animates this desire or what motivates this desire. So how come the voice has become such an appealing object in the contemporary world, particularly for people who have historically been marginalized and whose voices have not been heard very much? And I think that this has, you know, this desire for voice and its value has much to do with how we understand the voice today in many contexts as a sign of empowerment and agency. not just in Kurdistan or in Turkey, but globally. So, you know, think about, I think we all know these familiar refrains about, you know, you need to be vocal, speak up, you know, you need to voice your opinions, your ideas, your emotions. I think these are all very familiar terms to us, but that have a particular influence on how we understand the voice, and that link it with this idea of, you know, having a voice means having agency and being present. And so the book really tracks how such an understanding of voice, on the one hand, animates all these new desires and imaginations and aspirations, but on the other hand, how it also creates new contestations and new anxieties, new vulnerabilities. And so in a way, the book really, you know, kind of tries to critically examine this contemporary politics of voice, showing that, you know, when marginalized or quote-unquote subaltern people actually raise their voices, it's not always that straightforward path to liberation or emancipation that we sometimes imagine.
Yeah, and I mean, it was very interesting to read some parallels between your book and my dissertation research, where, I mean, speaking about sexuality has the same kind of connotations of, like, asserting agency, for instance.
Definitely,
so, yeah. That was very interesting, and it's, I mean, it's a beautifully written book. So, I mean,
thanks.
Congratulations. it was such a lovely read. And can you tell us a bit about the Dengbej tradition, maybe?
Yeah.
Because I heard Dengbej is in Diyarbakir, where I'm from. But I mean, there are similarities, but also these are women Dengbej, which I've never heard before.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about this?
Yeah, of course, sure. So Dengbej means literally it's a compound made up of two words, deng and bej. And deng means voice in Kurdish. It also means sound. And bej means the one who tells or the one who pronounces. And so Dengbej is the one who kind of tells with her or his voice. And Dengbej is a... it has become this very broad term, but it describes sort of a broad tradition of oral history telling and oral literature. So it's not exactly, it's a form of melodized speech. So it's sung in a way, it's melodized, but it's not necessarily the same as music that you would listen to for entertainment. So it's not the kind of music that you would turn on at a wedding to dance to. But Dengbej is really more a form of history and storytelling. So it's a kind of, so Dengbej would sing repertoires that people normally sit and enjoy to listen to. And they're also, what's really important is that it's mostly non-fictional accounts. So it means that the stories that Dengbej tell or that they sing about, they are non-fictional. They're taken to be truthful accounts, often of historical events. So you have a lot of repertoires, a lot of songs that tell of, for instance, tribal battles between different Kurdish tribes in the 19th century, for instance, or encounters between the Ottoman army and a Kurdish tribal leader, 100 years ago. So you have a lot of historical events that are recounted by Dengbej. Or, for instance, you have accounts of natural disasters, earthquakes, this kind of thing. You also have a lot of love stories. So a lot of accounts of love stories, interestingly, often between Kurdish and Armenian trans-religious sort of love stories. So it's also a genre that's by nature tragic. So the love stories, they always fail. It's always failed love, failed romantic love. So in the sense, because it's a kind of non-fictional form of storytelling, people also use it to transmit personal experience. So they sing about their own experiences, stories that they have encountered, and especially women. And here, you know, the gender difference comes in. So especially women use it a lot to talk also about their personal experiences, emotions, personal situations. This is not something that men will never do, but it's sort of it's a slightly sort of gendered way in which women repertoires can be more personal. They can be more, not more emotional necessarily, because, you know, as I said, it's a really tragic genre. So there's a lot of suffering in that genre in any case, even when men perform it. But it's interesting that also when men perform these repertoires, they will often cite women's voices. So often you have a character in the story that's a mother, for instance. And it's often that female character that's the one that expresses a lot of the suffering, and the tragedy is often expressed by women's voices, even when it's a man who is performing the song. So in that sense, there's definitely a gender dimension in these repertoires. And what's also important to know is that Deng Beige's and their repertoires have in recent years really come to be celebrated as symbols of authentic Kurdish culture and heritage. And so there has been it's driven by a lot of anxiety that these repertoires represent Kurdish history and they represent Kurdish culture, and that they are in danger of being forgotten because the older generations are dying out, essentially, and it's not necessarily transmitted to younger generations. There's also this idea that it preserves Kurdish language because, you know, there haven't been a lot of Kurdish archives. There hasn't been the chance to transmit a lot in written form. So oral forms of transmission have been really essential for Kurdish history and culture. And so in recent years, there has been a lot of activism trying to record Dengbej's voices and really archiving their repertoires in order to kind of preserve the culture and the heritage and the language that people see as being embedded in these repertoires. So that's also really important for my book project because it gives a new kind of value to these voices and that makes them particularly desirable, but that also creates a lot of conflicts and contestations around these voices that have become suddenly kind of imbued with this new value.
Mm-hmm. And maybe for those of our listeners who don't know the genre, we can put in the podcast notes.
Yes, definitely.
Link to your website where there's an archive.
Yeah.
Something by songs.
Exactly. Yeah. I have some on my website that people can listen to. And there's also lots on YouTube. I mean, definitely people can sort of, jump into this and you can spend hours listening to Dengbej if you want to. Definitely.
Great. We'll do that then. And how did you decide to work with like Dengbej women in your field research?
Yeah.
How did your path took you there?
Yeah, so initially I was kind of quite fascinated by, first of all, the fact that, as you said, Dengbej are mainly known to be men, and a lot of people don't know that they're also women Dengbej. And I had always been, as a foreigner, people had kind of, told me, you have to listen, if you're interested in Kurdish culture, listen to Dengbej, or, go to this Dengbej performance. And when I encountered these women, I was like, hold on, nobody ever told me that they're also women. What is this all about? Where do they come from? And how come nobody kind of ever mentions the women that are also involved in this? So this kind of was my initial fascination. But then I was also kind of very interested initially, really, in how these repertoires were a means of transmitting particular kind of stories. So I was really more interested in what was being told in these repertoires and exactly what are the gender differences. Also because these are repertoires that, because they recount, personal experience, you have a lot of repertoires that also talk about recent history, about the war and the armed conflict that has been raging in the Kurdish regions of Turkey for the last 30, 40 years. So initially, I was really interested in these repertoires as forms of kind of testimony and witnessing violence and oppression and the specific sort of gendered take on that from the part of women. So I was really more interested, in a sense, in the content. But eventually I realized that the voice didn't always function in these repertoires the way that I expected it. So women were not simply voicing kind of their own suffering or their own experiences, but they would often also voice, in a sense, the suffering experienced by others, often by men. And so I realized that the relation between voice and self was rather complex, which made it difficult to assume that the women, that I encountered, that they used their voices as simply a kind of straightforward means of self-expression or as a kind of personal testimony. And this really pushed me to think of the voice itself as an object that needs ethnographic attention. So not simply what voices say, but really the voice itself, rather than, you know, sort of assuming that it's this inconsequential channel through which just information is transmitted. It made me realize, oh, hold on, maybe I need to actually, you know, look at this channel through which, you know, all this content is transmitted. And so I think eventually then, you know, a lot of reading and thinking went into this, but eventually I was like, oh, okay, hold on. The voice really is not, I think we it's so natural to us to use our voices, right? That it becomes this naturalized object that we don't give that much thought to, actually. But I think, you know, what then eventually I came to realize is that, you know, that we think of the voice as being somehow naturally this means for us to express our inner selves and our inner emotions. That's actually culturally and historically and politically constructed. And it's not always, it doesn't have to be like this. But once it is like this, it also, the way in which we construct the voice has specific effects. And this is really what began to interest me in the way in which, you know, how has the voice been constructed? How are these constructions changing? And what effects does this have socially, politically, culturally? Yeah, basically.
And I mean, it is really fascinating to go through this book and see how carefully you attend to voice itself and what it does. And as you call it, the social labor, it kind of carries over. And I mean, I'm not someone who is well-versed in linguistic anthropology, but like, how does your work speak to that field in that sense?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm also not trained as a linguistic anthropologist, and sometimes it feels like linguistic anthropology is its own little world and it has its own code. And it's sometimes, you know, you need to do a lot of code switching to be able to get into linguistic anthropology. So the book is not written necessarily as a book of linguistic anthropology. I don't think I'm, you know, versed enough in linguistic anthropology, but it definitely borrows a lot from linguistic anthropology. And just reading linguistic anthropology has really helped me to come to an understanding of voice, or to defamiliarize myself, you know, and assume, not assuming voice to be this just naturally given thing. And it kind of has sensitized me to paying attention to how the voice works, what it does, and also really to look at, and this also is the same actually with ethnomusicological literature, which similarly, I'm not trained as an ethnomusicologist, and my book definitely is not an ethnomusicological book. I think ethnomusicologists would find a lot missing in the book. But reading a lot of ethnomusicology has made me, and linguistic anthropology has allowed me, I think, to really look at, not just as the voice as, you know, something that transmits content, but really look at the voice as form, or look at, you know, the poetics of the voice and the aesthetics of the voice, the sound of the voice, and really kind of interrogate what that means and what kind of effects a voice can have because of a specific way in which how it sounds or how it is used by people, and really get away from this kind of understanding where we immediately take the voice as, okay, having a voice means you have agency, which is a very symbolic understanding of the voice, you know. You make immediately kind of, you connect voice to agency, empowerment. Voice becomes a bit of an empty shell. But once you know, pay attention to the form of the voice and the sound of the voice, its poetics, you know, I think you can defamiliarize yourself with some of these kind of very common sense assumptions we have about the voice. And that, in that sense, linguistic anthropology and ethnomusicological literature has been really, really useful for me to be able to do that for myself, and then also hopefully transmit some of that to the reader.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. newbooksnetwork.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, I mean, as someone who has read very little linguistic anthropology and ethnomusicology, this book to me read as a book in linguistic anthropology and ethnomusicology. And I mean, one of the things that was great about the book was that, I mean, I also thought, I mean, usually, I mean, in sexuality studies, this is about visibility, right? Like how coming out and visibility, and it doesn't matter how you're visible, but then what you do in the book very well is to show it. Sometimes it doesn't matter what the voice say, but how it says it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's really, to me, a wonderful revelation. And you also talk about the social labor, if I can go back to what I was saying, like social labor of voice. Can you tell a bit about that and what do you mean by the social labor?
Yeah, sure. So social labor of voice is a term that allows me precisely to highlight, you know, what I was just saying, to move away from this understanding of voice as simply in itself an inconsequential, insignificant channel for communication, just a means to transmit content. But instead, really, it's a term that I use to bring into view what voices do apart from just saying or transmitting a specific content. And in that way, this is important, not just because it's interesting, you know, how voices sound and what kind of things they do, but I think it's important because precisely these assumptions about what I was saying in the beginning, that we so naturally take the voice to be an index of agency, of empowerment, of the self and of its will, you know, everything that comes across in these terms of, you know, be vocal, speak up, use your voice, you need to have a voice. This understanding relies very much on not paying attention to the form of the voice, but it relies on basically, you know, just assuming that the voice itself is inconsequential and that what the voice says matters more than how it says that. And so in order to make room, in order really to turn the voice into an ethnographic object and move away from this understanding that immediately connects voice to agency, self, presence, and so on, that's why I think it's really important to deconstruct, to look at the social labor voice and to look at its form and its sound and its acoustics, its poetics. And so, you know, just to give you an example of, you know, how this might look like. So for instance, in the book, I look at how when you look at these more traditional repertoires of Dengbej singers, you see that there is an enormous amount of kind of energy that goes into vocal elaboration. So there's definitely, it's about telling a particular story. So it's about transmitting content, but there's also a lot of energy that goes into vocal elaboration. And that vocal elaboration serves to transmit emotions and affects to listeners. And often listeners, you know, a good Dengbej is somebody who makes you cry. So here the voice and its elaboration, like really working with the voice. And this is something that I think singers probably in a lot of, you know, that's not just true for Kurdistan, but, you know, an opera singer, you know, might work in the same way. We're really like working on the voice and elaborating your voice is able to kind of connect, make affects and emotions circulate amongst listeners and audiences beyond sort of the boundary of the individual subject and, you know, beyond where the content itself might not necessarily be of the most important thing. So this is one thing that I note, the way in which in these more traditional repertoires, we really see the voice being used not just to transmit a specific story, but to make affects and emotions circulate and to really kind of be able to share pain and suffering in a collective way. But then when you look at what I also see is that Kurdish repertoires, these repertoires are changing in what I think is a response to the demands of these contemporary politics of voice that can only read voices as politically significant when they clearly express, you know, the interiority of a bounded individual. It's only when the voice expresses yourself and your opinion that it becomes a voice that's politically legible, that that matters in a political sense. And so I think what you see in newer repertoires, more recent repertoires of Ding Bears, but also other singers, is that the voice is much, much more tame in a sense. Like it's less elaborate. It becomes the intense kind of elaboration is often what younger people also find kind of boring and weird. And the voice becomes much more, really, in these more recent repertoires, you see that the voice becomes much more kind of focused on transmitting the content, which is often much more about the personal self of the person who is actually performing. Whereas a lot of the traditional repertoires, they, you know, they tell about suffering, but not necessarily the suffering of the personal suffering of the singer. It's often all very intricate stories that have, you know, all kinds of crazy things happening, a lot of tragedy, but it's not necessarily very personalized. Whereas I feel in newer repertoires, you see how the voice becomes much more simple, less elaborated, and the focus becomes much more on transmitting a certain type of content, which is much more tied to the emotional, personal self. And so I think this is really a response in some ways to these contemporary politics of voice that can read a voice as a voice that sort of matters in this political sense only when it is a voice that expresses the self and the interiority of the self. So I think you can really, by sort of tracking how the form of the voice, its poetics is changing, you can really see how that kind of creates also new understandings of the subject, of the self, of the community. And this is really something that the book in a way tries to do.
So kind of the liberal conceptions of the self is catching up with the new generation.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious it's not a linear transition or anything. Yeah, and these old repertoires remain immensely popular, you know? So people I really enjoy also listening to some of the older repertoires. But you can definitely see that there is some change happening and that people's also aesthetic sensibilities in a way are changing and what is considered a good voice is changing. Which has been interesting actually to track also when you compare older and newer generations of Dengbeis, how they are evaluated often quite differently. And so, yeah, I think also that there's new ideas about what a beautiful voice should be, which is a lot cleaner, I think, nowadays, a lot more tame. Like the voice is a bit more tame, you know, than I think it used to be in the past.
And I mean, as far as I could track down in the book, you talk about the relationship between raising one's own voice in different chapters, like to agency, resistance, healing, authorship, and regimes of perception. Can you tell us a bit about this complex relationship and how these different kind of tropes are becoming visible?
Yeah, sure. So, this, you know, it's a lot of, you know, different terms that you just mentioned and that also come up in the book. But I think in some ways, they're all, perhaps we can think of them as sites where we can track these repercussions of these liberal assumptions about voice as an expression of self and interiority that I was talking about. So, you know, you mentioned agency. So, you know, once my voice is understood as sort of naturally expressing myself, my opinion, my will, then it becomes an index of my agency. So having a voice means that I have agency, but it also becomes, you know, a means of resistance. So resistance is another trope, of course. Resistance to regimes or to powers that seek to kind of limit my agency and my will. So I think the two are very much linked. And this is, you know, why I think also the voice is so crucial for political campaigning, for political activism today, and also feminist activism. So obviously, so I write about Kurdish women, and we know that, you know, there's this very strong trope about Kurdish, about Muslim women in particular being silenced, lacking a voice. And we see that a lot of feminist activism has focused on, you know, either giving voice, but also encouraging, you know, Muslim women, for instance, to raise their voices, to speak up, to be vocal. And so I think we can really see and to resist, quote unquote, resist patriarchal oppression, for instance, by raising their voices. So we can see how, you know, this idea, a specific idea of the voice really guides a lot of political activism and campaigning. And I'm not saying that this is necessarily wrong. I'm just saying that this is a very specific understanding of the voice, and that this probably wouldn't have made sense a couple of hundred years ago, when maybe, you know, people didn't have this understanding of the voice. So I think, it, you know, we need to really understand how this kind of political activism around the voice is very much situated and is tied to specific understanding of voice. You also mentioned healing. So this is, I think, another, the book doesn't go into that much detail on the healing part, but there's a lot of excellent literature also written about this, the way in which the voice is absolutely has been central to a lot of therapeutic discourses and practices, where there's this immense emphasis on, you know, you need to talk about your suffering, your worries, your anxieties. You know, the whole Freudian psychoanalysis is all about sit down on the couch and talk, right? And so it's all about using your voice to as a means of eventually healing, or also reconciliation, so in a more kind of conflict studies kind of setting. So, you know, I think we are kind of at the contemporary moment, we find ourselves surrounded by, you know, all these, by these encouragements to raise our voices, you know, in order to heal, in order to gain agency, in order to become politically significant. So the voice is really central in, you know, once you start, you know, tracking it down, you see how it's really central to a lot of contemporary kind of political and social sides. And the book, in a way, kind of shows how, you know, once you really start focusing on the voice, how you can kind of track down what it does in these different sites, and what kind of social labor, to use the term that we were talking about, the voice does in these different settings. Another term you were mentioning, or that I'm mentioning in the book, obviously, is authorship. And so authorship, I think, becomes relevant because, you know, the voice is this desirable and valuable object in a way, because it carries all these promises of agency, empowerment, healing. And so, but once it has all this value, you know, you start having questions about who do these voices belong to? Who can claim the value that these voices kind of accumulate? And who should be the owner or the author of these voices? And in the book, I explore this, or I kind of started thinking about it, because I was sort of struck by how the women that I worked with were extremely keen on kind of claiming that they were the authors of particular songs. And they would have even fights about, no, this is like my song, or this is her song, or and it's interesting, because in the past, a lot of these songs would have simply been sort of collectively owned and practiced. So they would have been transmitted from generation to generation, from Dengbej to Dengbej, but there was not a lot of kind of investment in who does it specifically belong to, who's the author. But so I was kind of struck by how, you know, a lot of the women that I worked with were really kind of invested in this question of authorship and ownership. So the two of them kind of go together. And I think, you know, the kind of the way that I interpret it is that, you know, this insistence on authoring, on owning particular voices, particular repertoires, I think has much to do with the way in which particularly the voices of Dengbej, as we were also talking about, have in recent years become immensely valuable as symbols of Kurdish heritage, of Kurdish culture. And you can really see how women in specific specifically try to insert themselves into these circuits of value that have come to circulate around the voice, and that the voice has brought. And they really try to kind of step into that value and make a claim to part of that value that has come to circulate and that has come to attach to the Kurdish voice in contemporary Turkey. And so authorship is really a key trope here. And so I think this kind of also shows you how once the voice becomes this desirable, valuable object, it also creates a whole lot of conflicts and contestations that come with the kind of value that is attached to the voice.
Thanks for the complex answer to this complex question. Also, as you were talking, I mean, I was struck by this idea of you said like how feminists kind of giving voice is a concern for feminists. But then I thought about this, how this is also a very much a bled trope in anthropology itself, and like how, as if giving voice to disenfranchised communities automatically almost help the said communities. But yeah, and I mean your book definitely complicates even that relationship.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot to be said about how voice works in anthropology and how anthropology exactly has kind of seen itself as historically has seen itself as giving voice to perhaps marginalized communities that has obviously come under critique. And there's a lot of, we see a lot of experimentation with kind of polyphonic writing, multi-authorship, co-writing. So I think all of that in a way are responses also to questions about how voice functions in anthropology, of course. So I think it's definitely important to also think about and how voice functions in anthropology, and also perhaps to begin to think about, because also in anthropology, we kind of assume that the voices of our interlocutors are expressions of their selves and their opinions and their desires and their wills, right? This is what our whole enterprise in a way relies on. We go and talk to people assuming that their voices will kind of represent who they are. And I think, you know, it might also be worth thinking about that assumption and what that means for our practices of field work and our methodologies of research. So I think there's definitely repercussions for not only the politics of representation, but also really kind of how we understand the voices of the people that we work with.
Mm-hmm. And that's why maybe Malinowski says, listen to what they say, but also look at what they do.
Exactly. Yeah.
And what are you working on nowadays? What's the next project?
The next project, yeah. There's always a next project. Well, or several, or, but yeah. So I mean, actually, so what I didn't talk about much now is, but perhaps an interesting point also to mention is that the kind of the Dengbej repertoires are actually quite close to, in the way that they sound and the kind of structure they're close to, some of them at least are close to funerary lamentations, which is also why these genres are, you know, sort of full of tragedy and suffering. And this is also makes them specifically gendered repertoires, because lamentations are typically sung by women. And so I've actually also become quite fascinated with how in these repertoires, questions of loss and absence are kind of negotiated. And so in my next project, I'm hoping to go further in this direction by really studying questions surrounding death and afterlives, broadly speaking, in the context of the ongoing political situation also in Turkey's Kurdish regions. So broadly speaking, that's a little bit the direction that I'm going into.
Well, Marlene, thank you so much for being here and talking about your wonderful book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Hopefully we can meet again.
Yes.
To talk about your next book.
Definitely.